Hello, and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, I am coming at you from inside of a phone booth at work today. this is just goes to show what summer is sort of like for us, is that, yeah, a scheduling mishap happened on my end. Now I'm coming to you from here. I'm also not on my normal mic. Just everything's sort of a disaster today on my end. But how is it going for you? You just got back from a big trip.
Yes, I took a trip with my teenager to Southern Kentucky, mm-hmm. where we spent most of a week hanging out in and around Mammoth Caves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely have some RPG-related stuff I want to share with you, yeah. Insights. Anything we need to cover before we jump into that?
Well, I've just got a bad joke. Would you call this your colossal cave adventure?
That is a pretty bad joke, but I just laughed. That was genuine laughter. So
yeah, I guess so. If listeners, if you also heard that joke and laughed, you should probably schedule a visit with your doctor to talk about like a colonoscopy or something.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, Chris, I have a couple of things I just want to share from you from this membership. And they're RPG adjacent. Yeah. And then I have like an actual official RPG topic, also born out of my my colossal cave adventure. So the first thing I want to share with you, Chris, but maybe you already know this, it's just a historical fact. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a free adventure hook that that you can adapt it to any system. And do you know what the Kentucky Cave Wars were?
This sounds incredibly made up. No, I do not.
So what do you think the Kentucky Cave Wars were?
I mean, again, my TTRPG addled brain, I'm imagining there was something that started to come out of the caves that we had to fight back, sort of like, yeah, maybe just after the Revolutionary War, we decided we had to take on the mole people or something.
I don't want to disappoint you. That is not what the historical cave wars were, but good guess. So the cave wars were a period of time in the 1800s where, because people are people, as soon as they discovered that there was a bunch of caves in Southern Kentucky, everyone like grabbed one and tried to make it a tourist spot, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you compete with the 50 other privately owned caves?
Yeah, I mean, I think you compete on lying about what you're going to find in the cave, right?
Okay, so
like maybe there's, you know, especially 1800s, I'm thinking like, you know, come to the cave where we found the lost gold of indigenous people or something like that. So that's sort of my first guess. The other thing I'm thinking about is like the caves are all sort of interconnected, right?
A lot of them are.
Yeah. So I think there'd be a lot of turf wars about like whose cave started and ended where.
Well, those are some very good guesses. And I'm sure both of those were part of the cave wars. But so what you would do if you were a cave owner is you would look at like the brochure of your rival caves and you would notice the natural formations that were the selling point of that cave. Mm-hmm. And then you would hire a local gang of thugs to sneak in with sledgehammers to smash apart 1 million-year-old geological features.
Oh my goodness.
That made your rival's cave, that gave it its selling point. So
yeah, so it no longer has stalactites. It no longer has stalagmites. Exactly. It just has rubble everywhere.
So yeah, we were in caves and they were like, you have to imagine what this might have looked like before someone like sledgehammered out all of the stalactites.
Oh my goodness. So they were still trying to market it based on something that wasn't there.
yes,
which is the most American sensibility.
So if you can't work roving gang of cave wrecking thugs into your adventure, either as the team that your PCs are on or the team that your PCs are fighting, would also do other stuff, like they would impersonate, until this became illegal, they would impersonate police officers and they would pull you over if you were driving towards or traveling towards a rival's cave, and they would issue like an quote official government warning that cave had just had a cave in.
And they would
point you to the only safe cave, which was their employers or whatever. So
that is astounding. I mean how many people were coming to visit the cave such that like this grift was possibly worthwhile?
So a lot. A lot of it was an early American tourist thing, mm-hmm. when the concept of tourist location destinations was becoming a thing.
Yeah.
I think like Niagara Falls was like at this time the only other place that really pitched come visit this tourist area.
Yeah.
So I don't know what heavy traffic looks like in the, you know, mid late 1800s, but yeah, it was enough that a lot of people were trying to get rich doing it.
It sort of makes me wonder, like, in like, so tabletop games, right? Like, so you're always going into caves to, you know, clear it out of goblins or whatever, but
yeah,
very rarely, if ever, do you have sort of follow-up to like what happens happens after the fact. But setting up shop is like being a tourist destination makes a ton of sense.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, come to the goblin caves, you know, 100% goblin free now.
Like, yeah. Right. Yeah. To seg into a related thing, that was something else that RPG adjacent that I took from this trip, which is that I had not thought that an interesting, maybe the most interesting part of a cave's history is the history of how people have used it.
Mm-hmm.
I went down there thinking, well, I'm going to marvel a lot of like ancient geological stuff.
Yeah.
But most of the stuff I marveled at was stuff people had done in the last, I guess, couple thousand, but mostly the last few hundred years in or with the caves.
Yeah.
And we've talked a little bit about how it's just a very real thing that a location like a temple or a public building of some sort or any, you know, that any sort of interesting or big or communal structure will have gone through phases of use by different groups. If you can ask, you know, when you're building your dungeon, if you can ask not only what are the goblins doing in this cave, but who was here before the goblins and how is their presence? What are the like signs of their presence and what they wanted out of this cave? How are they still visible? That to me adds a lot of depth and like isn't much extra work. It adds a lot of depth to like the cave, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard about this called like the ecology, right? Of the cave, right? I mean, which is just thinking about like a little bit about the history, because especially thinking about like Mammoth Cave, right? Like, there's so much like just square footage down there that like it's not like every area needs to be like used to its maximum effect, right? Like forever, right?
Yeah.
So you could have whole sections of this place that's like the current inhabitants don't touch at all. It's just like, well, that's like, you know, that was the trash heap of the people that were here beforehand.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Right? We never go in there, right? Or like we're scared of it or whatever, right? Like there's all sorts of stuff you could hide in there while even still having sort of your like 5-room dungeon, right? Inside the cave, there could be a 6-room that's just like, you know, doesn't make any sense compared to the rest of it. But I mean, I think it could really kind of like, yeah, make your imagination of your players go really wild.
You could have pretty overt signs of the past strata, if that's the right word, of use.
Yeah.
Like in an area of Mammoth where we were, they found the body of like a 3,000-year-old miner who had been killed by rock. Thousands and thousands of people had been walking within like 10 feet of its rest of it like 100 years until they found it. It was just off the path in such a way that you had to go up there in a specific spot to notice it. And, you know, in your goblin cave, the stuff could actually be there going back a couple of different occupational strata, right?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, so that's nuts. Do you ever, I know you well enough to know the answer to, hey, have you ever gone like really cave exploring is no. Yeah. But like, have you ever like watched a video of like the people that go into caves and like squeeze through like tiny cracks and stuff to like get into deeper and deeper portions of the cave?
Chris, I'm going to blow your mind. Yeah. I have been spelunking.
What?
I know.
I did not expect this. Okay.
I know.
Yeah.
This was in way back in college.
Okay.
I think it was Pennsylvania. If they have caves in Pennsylvania, anyway, one of these.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We went spelunking the whole deal, squeezing around through tiny cracks, feeling claustrophobic.
Okay.
You know, scrabbling around. My main memory of that was I was with a group of other fellow stupid college students.
Yeah.
My memory is like we had a cave guide and he would just sometimes he kept pulling a Gandalf on us where he'd just be like, I'm gonna go off and do my own thing for a bit.
Yeah.
But you guys just proceed on ahead and I'm sure you'll be fine. And it's like,
yeah.
I mean, obviously he or she knew the cave well enough that they could just find us instantly wherever we were. But
yeah.
it was like when I read The Hobbit and Gandalf just leaves them sometimes, yeah. like, and it's like, well, aren't you supposed to be running the show? it reminds me of that experience in the cave. That's it.
Yeah, that is that's terrifying. Yeah, I mean, so whenever I watch those, I like, you know, it makes me want to have a panic attack. Like, you know?
Yeah,
yeah, just like the thought of squeezing in. It's mostly the thought of like getting stuck halfway through, yeah, through that, or not being able to get back through the way I came. It's like, great, now I'm gonna be the body that no one's gonna find for 10,000 years.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I had one other quick thing, unless you had more on that topic.
No, I mean, I could probably talk for hours about my worries about spelunking, but yeah, keep going.
Here's my other dungeon tip that I gleaned from this. 1 mile into Mammoth Cave,
mm-hmm.
You have to travel 1 mile underground across rocky terrain to get to it. There is the remains of a hospital for tuberculosis patients.
What?
So like 1 mile into the cave, it's a long trek. You turn around and there's the remains of these huts where consumption patients,
mm-hmm.
Like there was basically a doctor purchased Mammoth Cave and mm-hmm. he had this idea that the consistent climate down there would help.
Yeah.
Tuberculosis patients didn't, but he tried, but it was a good try. It was a good try.
Yeah.
And it just made me think if you were in like a D&D dungeon, like a couple, maybe two levels down, and you turned around and there was like a hospital or a medical clinic, you would say, this is too fake. Like, this is too silly. I'm playing D&D. I don't want this much silliness.
Yeah.
Obviously, no one would have put a hospital here. How would the patients get here? It's rough terrain. There's no lights. Like, but someone did in real life. So I guess this was my little reminder that it is actually very human and very believable that we just do weird stuff sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's maybe a reason or there's some logic that produced it, but like it's okay to put something really improbable or silly in your dungeon. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to move your game theme into the silly in order to do that, because we do that in real life.
Yeah, we do. There's the guy that does Wondermark, it's a webcomic that we were just talking about recently, it's still going, David Malky. He came into a talk that I saw one time about sort of like the age of invention.
Oh.
Like, you know, like back when like it seemed like there was, you know, a ton of stuff being invented all the time, right? Like at probably like 1800s or so. Right. It was just sort of like people would just try stuff. And he was talking specifically about like ballooning, like hot air ballooning and stuff. And it's just like, right, like people were just trying stuff just to sort of see if they could do it, right? Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we have this notion that these days we're all like modern and scientific and reasonable and stuff about things, but sometimes like we really do just sort of try stuff and see sort of what happens. So like, yeah, but I mean, to your point, right, the thought of like, oh, there's like a hospital, yeah, two levels deep in this dungeon, it's like that, what a detail, like, right, you'll never forget that in your life. And like, but also it took some kind of like weirdo in the 1800s to be like, you know what, this is gonna work.
Right, totally.
This is totally gonna work. I mean, like, there's so many things about that these days you'd be like, yeah, right, like to what you said, like there's no lights, like how are you gonna get people who are sick 1 mile into this place?
Right,
like,
how do you even get food down there?
Yeah, like, there's all sorts of questions that arise, but like, you can make it work, right? Like, I mean, yeah, we're very used to just jumping in the car to get to the grocery store. But like, if you didn't have that, like, you can also just, you know, get a big, you know, like get a big sack and walk through the cave with like, yeah, medicines and stuff. So what will, like, I guess, like, I mean, so that sounds pretty cool. Like, was there anything else that was just like, that kind of made your jaw drop when you got out there and into the caves?
I mean, a lot of it is jaw dropping. It's boring if I just tell you how beautiful and impressive some mm-hmm. of the formations were. One of the things I hadn't expected was that in there's only like 10 or 12 miles of Mammoth that are like quote open to the public mm-hmm. out of like, I don't know, 1,000 miles total.
Oh, geez. Okay.
So we visited a fair amount of those 10 miles over the course of a few mm-hmm. days. And everywhere I went, there was no surface that was not covered with signatures, with graffiti, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah.
Including like way into the cave, like miles into the cave. Our earliest graffiti we found, the date they often have a date. So we found one in like the early 1830s.
Wow.
So it's all these signatures, you know, going back a long time, 200 years. That's the kind of detail. I mean, maybe your goblin cave doesn't need to be full of scrawled graffiti signatures on the wall, but mm-hmm. that's like the most human thing in the world that you do, right? And yeah. like, obviously, it's like this universal impulse based on the thousands and thousands of graffiti signatures. Mm-hmm. There's this impulse to like carve your name in the rock.
Yeah.
So, you know, what would that look like in your goblin cave? You know, if you imagine that this cave has been around for a while, you know, and related to the question of what did people do in this cave before? You know, I think one of the interesting things to ask is, you know, like, what are those like dumb human or dumb elf or dwarf or whatever things that everyone who set foot in this cave is going to have done, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a cool rock formation? And everyone who walked by it reached up to like touch it because it was
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
And now it's like totally rounded smooth yeah. because of that, you know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Are there, so in Mammoth, up to as high as you can reach with your arm, all of the walls have been stripped of like this white chalky gypsum because mm-hmm. that's what prehistoric people would come in and they would like scrape it off the walls. So
yeah.
up until the top of where your arm can reach, there's like only just a lot of scrape marks.
Yeah.
So it just, I don't know, it just, those were the things I was not expecting from, you know, like a quote, beautiful natural
yeah.
location. And it was all like it was all the people stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like the imposition of like human will in places that does sort of make it interesting. And also like when you see sort of a lack of that too, I think it's also super exciting.
Yes.
As well. I mean, it does make me like, there's all sorts of like little storytelling bits you could do sort of within those details you mentioned too. Like I'm thinking about like, so like the scrape marks, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you could see maybe there's, you know, there's fewer sort of higher up, but like you can probably, like if you looked at all that, you could get like sort of an average height over yeah. time of Americans, right? Like you could,
oh,
you
know, totally.
Some stuff like that. Or like, I mean, with all the graffiti and stuff, I bet you there's a lot fewer messages written from like 2020 to 2022 in there, right? Because like pandemic yeah. stuff, like, you know, things along those lines where you can do some really fun storytelling stuff of like, yeah, like you notice all this graffiti on the cave walls, but there's like a suspicious absence of dates from like whatever 500 to 1,000 or something
okay.
you know, in your setting.
Imagine, yeah. well, you know, that's an interesting thing. I was talking to my wife a little bit about this, isn't it? So basically in probably like the 70s or whenever the government got really serious about this sort of thing, like mm-hmm. there's like, I'm sure people have snuck their signatures, but there's essentially a massive drop off in human graffiti in the cave starting
yeah.
probably in like the mid 1900s.
Yeah.
In a way, I feel a little sad for like, his, you know, people like 500 years ago,
yeah.
they won't have that. The record that we 20th century people left in the cave is different than
mm-hmm.
the record that like people up to that point left in the cave.
Yeah.
Right? So
I wonder how much gum had to get cleaned up. Yeah. Like yes. you think about, or like how much cigarette smoke was in that place, you know, back in the 70s, probably everybody was just, you know, smoking their way through the caves.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Did you have any other questions? Otherwise I can move us into our topic, which is listeners, you did not sign up for like a Mammoth Caves edition of Roll for Topics, but this is the world we live in. You're trapped in here with us. So
yeah. The only thing I want to mention is so like I went to Mammoth Cave when I was younger. I was probably like 10 or so. My family took a lot of family vacations, sort of like what you do, but like, yeah, they drag us everywhere. Of course, I appreciated absolutely none of them.
Oh,
you know,
of course.
The time I just wanted to be playing Nintendo
yes.
instead. But the thing that I remember from going to Mammoth Cave most was like the temperature drops. So like, again, thinking about like ways to sort of like involve your players in the ecology and stuff.
Yeah.
Like I just remember like you'd sort of be outside and then you'd walk and as soon as you sort of got within the cave, like the temperature would drop like 10 degrees or whatever.
Yes.
Like it felt like there was almost this like line that you crossed. And I remember sort of going back and forth between it because I was just like so amused by it. Again, because I wanted to play Nintendo games.
Instead.
But like,
right, yeah.
yeah, but like it like really struck me as this sensation. And I think we often, you don't really talk about it much in games unless you're really like tuned into that and trying to bring that up quite a bit. But like, there's all sorts of things you can do just to like set your players on edge, right? Or
yeah.
or to otherwise give them a flavor of what's going on in the cave, just to, like by hitting some of those senses. Like, yeah, like you you walk into the cave and like the temperature drops or the temperature rises, or like you smell something, or like, right, like the light gets dim, right? There's all sorts of things like that. And I think I'm jealous of you that you got to go, because like now I really want to go and sort of like experience that.
Oh, it was really worthwhile. On that point, you're exactly correct. So there is the main entrance to the cave. It's quite big.
Mm-hmm.
But my teenager and I both commented on this. It's just on the side of a hill, a forested hill. You could walk within like 30 feet of it and not know that it was there.
Jeez.
So like when you think about adventurers or whatever, you know, looking for a cave entrance or a dungeon entrance, mm-hmm. what tips you off that's there is like exactly what you say. When you get within like 30 or so feet of the cave, the temperature drops like 15 degrees from mm-hmm. the cold air coming out of the cave.
Yeah.
And it's really striking. Like you say, it's almost like a boundary you can cross, where like out here it's like 88 degrees, and then mm-hmm. 10 feet over in this direction it's like 73.
Yeah,
it just makes me think, you know, how little maybe as a GM I employ different senses like that in the mm-hmm. way that adventurers are like searching or perceiving their environments, right? Like what does it smell like here, what's the temperature like right here, you know, all of that stuff can, you know, that could be a great clue. You find the cave entrance because you found the cold spot, and now you know you're pretty close to it, right?
Yeah.
That's way more fun than like, okay, give me a search roll. Yeah, you find it. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you send your familiar up in the sky, and it sees the entrance. Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay, yeah. Well, that's the last thing I wanted to mention. That's super cool. All right, so it sounds like you have a more specific RPG topic.
Yeah, I have a specific RPG question. This is a question I'd just like us to chat about for a little bit and hear your take on it. I'm sure we've touched on this a little bit in the past, but here is my question. I'll ask the question, and then I'll give a little context why this is on my mind. How do you handle light sources in dungeons?
Yeah.
And here's the context for this. So one of the things we did at Mammoth, which I recommend if you visit, is we took this 3-hour hike about 3 miles through Mammoth. It's called a lantern tour.
Okay.
And it's where all the lights are off and you are just carrying an old fashioned lantern. And the idea is to like recreate what it was like to be a tourist in like the 1800s.
Okay.
When the caves were not lit. And they didn't have like electric lights down there or anything like that. And so you just had this lantern. And before that, you just had torches.
Yeah.
I've run so many dungeons, and this topic has been a part of D&D type games in my life for years, you know, like torches, lights, etc. Mm-hmm. But you just have to see what it's like to walk through a pitch black cave with a lantern to it just hit me. This would be the single most important thing on the adventuring party's mind mm-hmm. is light, because it affects everything. And without the light, you can't do anything. Like if our lights had gone out partway through, we would, you know, we would just be dead. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit because this is a well-trod, you know, tourist attraction, but, you know, if you're in an unknown cave system and your light went out, I mean, that's it. You're done, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like if you're a couple levels deep into the dungeon, you're never getting out. And anything that lives in here, you are completely just at their whim, right?
Yeah.
And then the type of light that you use like has this dramatic effect on how you perceive the environment and what you can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the person, like we had a guide with us, and she pulled out like a lighter to simulate, you know, early explorers would go down there with candles and like mm-hmm. Holding a candle, that I'm telling you, that's not much light.
No.
And then we had our own lanterns, which even with a small group of like maybe 20 people and holding about maybe 10 lanterns, it's not enough. That does not illuminate the whole environment, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That just got me thinking. So I guess I would like to just ask you, so how have you or how would you handle light in a dungeon? And like, let's talk about why you handle it that way.
Yeah. It's a super good question. I'm kind of surprised we've never, never like specifically talked about it. Yeah, I think like every time I've run a game that has like dark vision in it, right? Or like, yeah, whatever it's called, but like, right. So you have certain characters that you can sort of just see in the dark. It feels like it really does take away something from the dungeon. So when I was younger, like in my 20s, there was like one week or two where I did just try to live by candlelight. Like just sort of for fun to see, right? Cause this, this is the sort of thing you can do when you're unattached. A bachelor. Yeah. So like we, you know, I just had candles and I just remember being like, it was very weird, right? Cause if you're used to just always having sort of the glow of a screen with you, like where you can, like, I mean, heck, like our phones all have flashlights on them now. Like that's even sort of like a more recent thing that everybody's carrying a flashlight all the time with them. But like, yeah, that candlelight, like it's sort of barely enough to do stuff by. Like you can read something that's like maybe, you know, a foot from your face or something like that, but it falls off so rapidly. Yeah. So the thought of going into a dungeon with anything short of, yeah, like a lantern is just like, no, like you would never do that. Right. Like, yeah. So to me, it sort of gets back to the question about like, how much of this sort of like inventory tracking do you want your players to have to do? Right. It's like, it's the same question for me of like, are you going to make them count arrows or rations or things like that? It's like, are you going to have to count your torches or your lanterns or whatever? Like to where like, that's not something I'm super interested in doing, but like, as you mentioned it, it's like, yes, like I would love to have like the quality of the light be part of the conversation. So like, yeah, like you're going to have it, but sort of tell me like, what do you have access to? Do you have access to a floodlight or do you have access to, a candle like that? So that's like, I think that's an interesting question, but yeah. So anyway, but going back to like when I've run games where like, yeah, the like, right, you have, everybody has dark vision or something. It's just like, it's just not as fun. Like it sort of takes away from what the dungeon can be. Or then you have situations where someone has it, someone doesn't. So it's just like, well, I'm just describing everything to them as I see it.
Yes.
But like, then I don't know, like the step that I never take is like, I don't know, like how well do you describe it? Right? Like, you know, like let's make some checks to see how well you're doing this. Because I mean, like if you've ever had someone try to lead you around just by like holding your hand or telling you what direction to go, like that's super hard too, right? Like that should make everything happen sort of with disadvantage if you're trying to do it. So anyway, so that's sort of my ramble on that.
Yeah, I'll ramble in turn. When I first started playing when I was younger, mostly playing Middle Earth, which is based on Rollmaster, which is a pretty crunchy sort of game. So I did torches and stuff the literal or realistic way where, you know, your torch, it gives light out to 20 feet and someone has to use a hand to hold it. And this is how long it lasts. And I quickly just kind of stopped doing that because it's fiddly. So you have like different people with maybe different light sources and different abilities to see in the dark. Right.
Yeah.
And managing all that makes you ask a couple. That means every single turn you have to ask a couple additional questions and just that quickly became tedious. And it also, as even though that might seem realistic, it's not really that realistic because light doesn't work like exactly at 20 feet, like you see nothing beyond it, right?
Yeah.
And you know, what do you do about what if you don't have a light source if you don't have a light source, but like the enemy does, you can see them from like way far away. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you want to do it kind of realistic, you have to start managing all this stuff per person, per combat round. Right. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, that was too much, but it also, you know, having been in Mammoth, you know, the things that light affects are not just like, can I see the goblin or not? It's like, how likely am I to get injured or to trip?
Yes.
And because that was, I mean, everyone in the group stumbled a couple of times because of light. You would not, in a way that you would not if there were just floodlights. I feel like around third edition D&D, like the game itself started sort of recognizing that this was not interesting for a lot of people. And so you started getting stuff like, really common, you can go to buy from a store, you can buy whatever, a glowstone or, you know, some hand wavy thing that's just like, yeah, okay,
you can see
you have this thing, you can all see, or here's a cantrip that can make something just be a light source for 8 hours or something.
Yeah.
And that's all fine and good, but like you say, it leaves you with the feeling, I don't really want to fiddle around with all this light stuff, but I wish there was a way to make it fun because it seems like that's interesting. That could be interesting.
Yeah, there's a. Can I talk about video games for a minute?
Please.
Do you have my permission?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's two games that kind of like jumped out to me. So one is Dark Souls, like the first Dark Souls. So there is a.
I was going to say only if it's about Final Fantasy or Dark Souls.
Yeah, okay, good.
I didn't even need to say that.
You didn't need to say it. Although, wait for my second one.
Oh, right? Cool. Yeah. Oh wow.
So there's a section of the game where you're going down, like, I think it's called the Catacombs. You're going down to fight Gravelord Nido, who's like this like giant
witch. Yes. Very memorable part of the bottom of the whole world.
So you're descending and you keep on descending and descending and descending. But the big like hook for that area is that it is dark. It's pitch black. And like, you don't have dark vision in this game. So you have to go acquire an item that gives you light if you want to be able to see, or memorize the path.
Yeah,
basically, right? Like, there's like a couple ways to get through it. Of course, all the speedrunners will just sort of memorize the exact places. And the fun part about that game is there's some platforming where you just have to sort of jump off into nothingness here and there as well, which is super fun in that game. Yeah, so and that game does track fall damage quite a bit. It's such a big change from the rest of the game, right? So like the rest of the game, like it might be dark, you know, it might be light, all that. Like it's that section in particular where you just cannot see in front of you, and it really changes your like how you approach the game, because like they of course like around every corner is some sort of enemy that's going to like completely kill you if you don't know where they are, and if you don't have a light source and you haven't memorized all those locations, like you just don't know, like, so you're just gonna get
and if you have a light source, you're not holding your shield
that's the big thing.
Yeah, so do you want to fight this thing in the dark, or do you want to fight it without a shield?
Yeah, and like, I mean, even that is a huge question that you could be asking in your games. It's like, okay, so let's say you're carrying a lantern, how are you carrying that lantern, like, right? Like, are you gonna put it, you know, try to hang it to your person to where it's like gonna get jostled around and might go out, or you know, yeah, not have a shield and then or not have your like your second great axe that you can carry, mm-hmm. or whatever. So it's a really fun sequence because it makes you sort of ask different questions about how you would maneuver in a space than you have been throughout the rest of the game. So I mean, it's for sure, like, I mean, that is just like, yes, I mean, of course, please play with that in your games. Like, yeah, the ability for you to see. The second game that I was thinking about was Silent Hill. I think it's Silent Hill 2. There is a section in that game, and I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, but like you have to go in an elevator at one point, and the elevator can only carry a certain amount of weight, and that weight happens to be exactly what your character weighs without any of its inventory.
Oh, that's right. Brutal.
Yeah, so you throughout most of the game, you have this radio that sort of tells you, that can like pick up static of where there's enemies in nearby. So it has this like staticky sound, and then you also have a flashlight too, right? So you can see what's going on. So all of that, in addition to your guns and your weapons and all that, have to go in this sort of like this holding tank, like this holding area for you to go in this elevator. I don't even remember the exact details. You go in this elevator, right? And then it's like, yeah. So it's from there, I mean, you can imagine if you've been stripped away of everything that you have, including your light source, which is just this like important thing that you've gotten used to. It's like what sort of emotions that would make your players feel as well. Like, you know, especially playing that game, it's very terrifying.
Yeah.
But I mean, you think about like, it would be horrifying, right? Like you mentioned, if you lost your light in the cave, like you would just die. Like, I mean, try to do that to your players at some point, like sort of see how their creativity goes, right? If they get pretty far into the dungeon, it's like, and then you can't see anything, right? Like, what are they going to do? Like, there's ways to get out probably, but like, I mean, that's a good challenge, I think, to throw in front of them.
Totally. And if your pack of goblins that are maybe hunting the players through the cave, I mean, they don't need to fight you and get slaughtered by your high level characters.
Mm-hmm.
They need to like throw a rock and hit the light source.
Yeah.
Right. And then you're all just dead. They can just pick you off in the dark. Right. Or whatever.
Yeah. Thinking about going through like the Mines of Moria, right. Like without a light source. I mean, like there's just some very vivid scenes in there. Like, right. So the Balrog is a light source.
Yeah.
Right. Like all of a sudden that's coming at you. And it's like, yeah, like you mentioned, you can see, if your enemy's holding a light source, you can see them. But like, imagine if your enemy is the light source itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could actually have a lot of fun with that. It's like, if you're in the cave, you've lost all your light sources, but the one thing that you can see is the enemy. So it's like, how do you lead the enemy out of the cave before you kill it?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can see where you're going.
I have this picture of a band of adventurers hauling the body of the Balrog on like a tarp through like the cave as their light source.
Yes, but, yeah, trying, yeah. yeah, cut off one of its arms, uses a torch.
Have you seen any games? I know that newer school games, some of them do stuff with like torches. Like I know, is it Shadow Dark or something? It uses them as like a real life timing mechanism, and I know that some games use light sources as a sort of meta currency.
Yes.
And I'm drawn to those, even though I also feel like they do not quite nail the experience, even if they provide a different experience. It's kind of neat. Yeah. Have you seen cool uses of light or torches in an RPG?
I mean, the one thinking about like meta stuff, the one that comes to mind is 10 Candles, right? Like that's a game where like, right, you light 10 candles and they kind of slowly go out over the course of the game. And that is also one where you have, if that's your light source, like even as you're trying to read all your notes, your notes that you have written, like you're going to kind of hold them up to the light as well. Like, so that's a very like, a very physical way, I think, to like kind of get your mind around this idea of light. But yeah, I haven't played any of the newer games that really play with that. I know there's a handful like that you mentioned where it's like, it's really, you are tracking torches and that's sort of the main thing that you're doing in the game.
Your mention of 10, is it 10 candles? How many candles? Okay.
10. Yeah. 10.
Yeah. One of the problems with like light stuff is anything that ultimately is expressed just as like a penalty to die rolls to me is boring.
Mm-hmm.
What if you have a couple of lights in the room, or you have like a dimmer switch and in your game room, and the number of light sources affects like how high you turn that dimmer switch up in the room. And so if only one person is willing to give up a free hand to carry a torch, then that dimmer's way down and everyone's got to squint at their character sheet. I mean, maybe that would be irritating after about 7 minutes, but
I mean, it's
more interesting than like, well, it's like kind of dim here, so everyone just remember you have a -2 to all of your rolls or whatever. That's very boring.
Yeah. I think there's a lot you could do with that. Even if you like, if you played with like minis on a table too, like I even wonder if you could do, I mean, this is getting like pretty technical into like some mini design, but like, I wonder if you could have a light source that is attached to each of them that you could control. So it's like, you could really see the fall off right at that point. And then your GM could kind of like, place stuff in front of you as you're walking through, and you can get your fog sort of.
I do think we are in a place, hobby-wise, where that's exactly the sort of like niche thing, like a realistic light LEDs or something
for
your miniatures. It would cost like $350.
Yeah.
Like, and
Kickstarter launches in a couple of weeks. So
Exactly. Okay. Well, let's quick declare ownership of that idea. So if you make $1 million on your Kickstarter, you owe me and Chris. So
take us out to lunch.
All right. Okay. Well, hey, any final thoughts on lighting, or like, here's one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen, setting aside the question of like light radiuses and penalties and stuff, have you seen light used in a cool way in an RPG? Like, has there been a moment where the light or lack of it created a neat effect for you?
You know, in the sort of games I play, I don't think it really comes up that much. And I don't know if this is just sort of a limitation of my creativity or whatever, but it, like, as we're talking, I just keep on thinking about it in terms of crunch, like crunch and rules. That's what I filter it through. It's like, oh, like if there was just like one cool rule to sort of handle it, like maybe this would make me like super interested in it.
Yeah.
But like, I wonder, I mean, like, so like going back to 10 Candles, I think like that's the game that you mentioned light. And I think about that because it is just such a, like such a physical manifestation of like, of like what the game's trying to do, and then also just like being able to see in the room like that. I mean, it's a game that I think everyone should try at least once. Once, just for that reason, just to kind of get your mind going, even if just like, oh, like I can do, you can kind of sort of like do weirder stuff at the table, than just rolling dice.
Yeah. So I guess if you've done something cool, write in and let us know. Here's my GMing challenge for all of you listeners. The next time you run a game, I want you to turn off the lights and bring in an actual old torch.
With yes.
Like dripping, flaming grease or something all over the place. It's like this sputtering smoke that will smell up your room for the rest of eternity. And tell me how it goes. So.
Make your players actually have to light a torch while you're rolling attack rolls against them.
Okay, well, hey, yeah. This was a fun conversation, Chris. Unless you had any final thoughts, so I think we can wrap up.
No, nothing right now. I will sort of tease the next time that we talk. I will have finished Cloud Atlas by then, and I'm gonna have probably a lot of things to ask you you to talk about.
I can't wait. I have absolutely zero answers for you, but it'll be fun to talk about that.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay. All right, let's wrap up there. So this has been Roll for Topic. We're part of the Roll for It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splat Book with John Corey and Kyle Latino, is amazing. You can go check them out at thesplatbook.com. They have been playing Kyle's new game, Starborg, which is a Morkborg hack that is very Star Wars-esque. they've been doing an actual play of that. Andy was on that. I listened to the first episode. No spoilers, but I think Andy's character should probably leave the party and go and save himself before the events of part two come out.
I had the same thought while I was playing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really fun. Kyle's a fantastic GM, and the players who are playing are pretty good. So it's Andy and John, and then our friend Ben as well.
Yep. There, so super fun game. It nails a particular aesthetic lens through which you can look at Star Wars.
Yeah. That actually reminds me, I had one other topic that we're going to have to just save for next time, and I will just leave you with this. Is Star Wars a genre in itself?
I love to talk about that. Let's put a pin in that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, all right, so I think that does it for us. So I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rao.
And remember, if your player's having fun, you're a great GM.